Good morning. You've joined The Real Cost of Fiber from NC Broadband Matters. We'll get started in just a second. Good morning, folks who are joining. The Real Cost of Fiber from NC Broadband Matters. We'll get started in about a minute. All right, Doug, it looks like pretty much everyone who's joining has joined. If you'd like to take it away.
Very good. Well, welcome everybody to our webinar today on the real cost of fiber. This is a follow-up to a webinar we just did a month ago where we talked about issues about building fiber networks and wireless networks. And we got a lot of follow-up questions and interest. And so this wasn't particularly planned at the time, but today we're going to really dig into the issue of fiber a lot deeper and talk about some of the true issues of costs. It seems like that's something that everybody wants to know. And so in order to do that today, we have a panel of folks who can answer your questions because they are associated with building fiber. So this is the right group of folks to talk to you about it. And so we're gonna first talk about buried fiber, right, Gene? And then aerial fiber, or is it the other way around?
Other way around,
aerial fiber and then buried fiber, and then we're going to dig really deeper into the whole topic of fiber with Mark Boxer here today. So let's jump right in here, and the first person that we're going to talk to is Gene Scott from Greenlight and Wilson, and he's going to talk to you in detail about the real cost of fiber aerial construction. So go ahead, Gene.
All right, thank you, Doug. As Doug said, the topic today is the real cost of fiber, but I wanted to make a couple of opening comments before we dive right into aerial construction. We want to start today by laying out some of the typical things you need to consider when building a fiber optic network, and then step back and look at what the real long-range cost of fiber is. I'm going to start our conversation with aerial construction, as Doug mentioned, the considerations, and give you some examples of the costs associated with the different aspects of this type of build. And then Greg will pick up and he's going to do the same thing with the buried portion or buried construction. And as you listen to Greg and I, you may start to think, well, building fiber can be expensive, but we're going to have our third speaker, which is Mark Boxer, and he's going to put all this into perspective for us. Mark is going to tell us or explain that over a period of time, the real cost of fiber becomes less expensive than the other technologies that are available today, plus it's future-proof. So there are different considerations to think about. And this is why fiber is still the technology of choice, and why many organizations, including the one that I work for and Greg works for, choose fiber for our networks. And we'll just step right into talking about aerial construction. If you could go to the next slide for me, Doug. Things to consider when constructing a new fiber optic facility, as all these things affect cost. And there, I want to give people some different things to look for and some of the associated costs with each. One of the first things you need to think about is who owns the poles. Now, if you own the pole line yourself, as the city of Wilson does, then this is not a big factor. But if someone else owns a pole, say the power company, for example, whether it's Duke or one of the co-ops, then pole ownership can affect your costs through the permitting fees, which we're going to give you some examples of those here in a few minutes. These fees can be reoccurring for every year for every attachment. So that's something you have to think about. And the condition of the pole line, because this is going to affect your make ready. And we'll talk about make ready here in a minute too. But you have to look at factors such as the height and class of the pole, age of the pole line. Can proper clearances be obtained from other utilities such as the electricity and over your streets and highways? And can the poles be accessed by trucks, or will it have to be climbed? And we'll talk about that in just a second. And something else to think about is your organization, does it have the resources today to maintain the plan in-house, or do you need to contract that out? Doug, if you'll flip for me. All right, permitting fees. Now, this is just some examples and that I've read about. They may vary in other regions of the country. But pole attachment permitting fees can range from about $5 to $15 per attachment per pole. And that doesn't sound like a lot of money, but then when you start thinking about on average using about 240 feet, 250 feet per span, if you calculate that over a mile, you get 22 poles per mile. A single attachment could run you $110 to $330 in fees, which are going to be incurred for that mile every year. So if you have a 10-mile network, you multiply that by 10. And remember, it's reoccurring. The make-ready cost I mentioned earlier, what is make-ready? Well, make-ready is the cost to bring the pole into compliance with the National Electrical Safety Code, plus any of the owner's specifications. Now, the owner's specifications may require additional work over and above what is necessary if you're following a National Electrical Safety Code. And all this can affect the cost of make-ready very much, and it can vary quite a bit. There may be no cost for some poles. A pole may be fine. There's plenty of clearances on the pole already. And sometimes you can have considerable cost for every single pole. And if you just look at the picture that's in that example, in the slide, if you'll notice, then not only you've got high voltage power, but you've got to deal with Department of Transportation streetlight circuits. There's also existing telephone, cable TVs on that pole. And then you're going to come along if you elect to build a fiber network and have to find space on that pole. And if we go to the next slide, Doug. I actually, this is a true example. This was from around 2012. I was helping someone with a design, and we were going to build it aerial initially. The power company wanted to charge us $42,000 for only 7 pole attachments. I went back and did a redesign, and we actually buried it cheaper than what we would have had to pay just to make the make-ready charges. Then the other thing to consider, we mentioned before, can trucks access the pole line? If they can, and they can, say, typically here in Eastern North Carolina, because most of our electrical pole construction is near the highway, the speed of construction can increase, and therefore your cost per mile drops. Obviously, you can get more constructed in a given day for the same labor cost. But if the pole has to be climbed by linemen, such as the mountainous areas where Doug lives, for example, then the production cost is going to, your production will drop and your cost is going to increase because you have to actually manually climb every pole, and it just slows things down. Another thing to consider, and this is an actual example that I had from about 18 months ago, if there's a railroad crossing involved, and this is for just an aerial crossing, Greg may be able to give examples of buried crossings, but depending on the railroad and what they require in this particular case, we had to spend over $10,000 to prepare and submit the required engineering documents and drawings. And that's not construction. That is just actually the engineering cost and the document preparation fees to get permission to build a pole line or build a fiber facility. Doug, if you want to flip over. Another study I did, this was probably from 2014. We wanted to look at, in a general sense, is how much did it cost per mile to build aerial fiber plant using the two common methods, which is strand and lash and ADSS construction. Strand and lash, it calculated out to be $15,420 to $21,588 per mile. Now, this is your material and labor. together, but it is not for splicing. Splicing is going to vary so much that to do a hypothetical on that, it would be meaningless, but construction cost per mile would run you somewhere in that range. And that is here in eastern North Carolina. It is not in an area that's mountainous, again, in an area such as where Doug lives. And also note that if you do this type of construction, it's going to have to be in the communication space on the pole. And for those of you that are not familiar with that, it's going to be your lowest location, the furthest away from your high voltage electrical power. ADSS construction, ADSS stands for all dielectric self-supporting. You got a little more flexibility. It can be placed up, say, in your supply space on the pole, which is above the communication space. It's actually calculates out to be a little more expensive, but you have some more flexibility, which may save you some make-ready costs. But approximately $23,647 to $33,106 per mile for that type of construction. Again, that's not the splicing. It is just the materials and labor to hang the cable itself. Okay, Doug. Now, this just gives you some general ideas of aerial construction costs and things to look at and what they're based on. And I'm going to turn it over to Greg now, and he's going to talk about buried construction, some of the things you need to think about and the cost associated with that.
And before they do that, I just want to jump in 1 second. Like most folks in the telecom industry, I drive around looking up in the air. That's what we all do. We look at the poles. There are a lot of poles in Western North Carolina where the poles literally run through the woods, because when the poles were built 70 years ago, they were on the right, they were all by themselves on the side of the road, and we now have 70 years of tree growth around them. There's pole lines here that you can't even find the poles. So it's very much more expensive to build in those places. So mountainous building can be a challenge for sure. So yeah, Greg, if you want to jump in here, Greg is from River Street, and we want to talk about underground construction.
Certainly. I appreciate everybody allowing me to take a few moments today and give you our perspective on underground construction for fiber. I'm with River Street Networks, and we're a 69-year-old independent telephone and now broadband cooperative serving from the mountains to the coast in North Carolina. And we've had a lot of projects going on over the last few years. Most everything we do is underground. So let me give you some details of how we try to do that. If you'll go to the next slide. The first thing I'd like to talk to you about is the fiber count and the network design, which has to be considered on the front end. And as a part of the fiber count and the network design, we focus on the cable sizes and how they factor into the cost. And so each fiber tube is going to have a certain number of strands of fiber inside of it. And that will impact your cost, because if you're running down a main highway and you're heading from one community to the other, you might want to put in a large count fiber. Say maybe an 864 count or 576 count. If you're going into an urban area, it might be a little less. And then in small rural builds where you may have small housing units of 12 or 24 homes, then you would obviously do much smaller cable size. So all of that impacts the cost of the actual materials. On average, 2/3 of your cost is putting the fiber in the ground, and the other 1/3 is the labor. So we look at glass as being cheap compared to the labor. And so therefore we try to over-engineer and put extra cable or extra fiber in to grow as the communities could potentially grow. We also look at where would you locate the electronics, the placement of the electronics when you're building. Will those electronics be placed on a state right-of-way, or will you need to secure easement or even buy land from private landowners for placement? All of that will factor into your cost. The type of network you build, and we usually build one of two types of underground fiber networks. That would be either an active network, and that's where you have one fiber that runs to every customer, and it goes from the customer's premise all the way back to an OLT or an optical line terminator. This is really kind of the more expensive approach, but it's a one-to-one where you have the customer connected directly to an individual electronic port. Then there's the other network that we build, which is a passive network or a PON network, as we refer to it. We have tons of acronyms. But on a passive network, we would have one fiber leave that OLT and head towards the community. And then it would split and go to individual houses through a splitter. And so those splitter types can be in various sizes, but you've got 32 down to 16 or down to 8, which means you feed the splitter with one fiber back from your electronics, and then you can feed 8 homes with an 8-port split. So all of these get factored into the cost of building a network. And each community is going to have a different setup, and the project will be different, and it'll require careful consideration in your network design. Next slide, please. In the installation and labor side of things, as Gene mentioned earlier, you may have the ability to do some of this work in-house. But over the years, that's become more and more rare. As many of us companies are focused on serving our customers, we tend to outsource the contract work and have a turnkey type solution to install that fiber. One of the things that we try to focus on too, if we can, is if there are available contractors locally that can be accessed locally wherever we've got a build job. This doesn't always work out, but if you do that, it can help reduce your overhead. Because if you think about it, when the contractor comes into town to do work, he's going to bring his whole crew, and he's going to have to put them at a hotel or some kind of a place to live during the temporary time that they're doing the install work. And that's going to inflate your costs, because now the contractor is going to have to pay for housing and food and other things that normally could be offset if you can find a local contractor where at the end of the day, the construction crew actually leaves and goes back home. And so that's one way that you can save some money. Another thing that you would be interested in focusing on, if you are a company that is receiving any kind of federal funding through a grant mechanism to build a broadband network, is the Davis-Bacon Act, which is often referred to as the prevailing wage. It was set up in 1931 by the federal government, and it basically requires contractors and subcontractors that are working on federally funded jobs to make sure that their laborers' wages and benefits are no less than what other locally people pay their workers for similar projects. And that's why it's called the prevailing wage. And if you're being funded with federal money, you have to abide by this. And there's certain strict rules where you have to receive payroll in from your contractor on a weekly basis, and you have to turn that back in to the account manager that's handling your account, or the auditor that might be auditing your federal application and grant funds. There's a list on the U.S. Department of Labor that posts what the prevailing wage is that they require. And then the last three items here is trenching, plowing, and boring. And so obviously when you start a project, several years ago, we would do a lot of trenching, and that's where you go in and you physically dig up an area through the ground that may be a foot wide or so and X amount of feet deep. And then you drop the cable in there, and then you have to use a machine to pull the dirt back over and smooth it out. And through the methods of plowing, it's less disruptive on the earth. And that's kind of important when you're thinking about going through potential customers' yards or businesses' yards. If you can plow it in, you actually cut a small slit into the earth and inserts the cable down there. And when the plow goes through, you can hardly even tell that anything's happened. Of course, with the rain that we've been having in North Carolina, there's not been a whole lot of plowing or really any kind of construction right now, because you would almost have to have a boat to do it. The other thing is boring. Boring can really inflate your cost. And I'm going to talk to you in just a second about urban versus rural. But in a boring situation, you would use that in the event that you can't plow across something like maybe pavement or asphalt, or maybe you're having to go under something like a canal or a creek or a river. And boring costs can be kind of expensive. We've seen average cost anywhere from $15 to $20 per foot under major highways. and they require you to go 12 to 15 feet deep, and you've got to be a certain amount of distance on each side. So you can see how that $20 per foot would start to add up just on one little area that you would need to get fiber under something. And so next slide, please. So in the urban versus rural slide here, a couple of items that I wanted to mention to you is we have to consider what's in my path as I'm building this fiber. And if I'm urban or rural, that's going to be completely different. In most rural environments, you're going to have a straight shot and you're not going to have a lot to deal with. And that can keep your cost really down. But when you start jumping it up to small towns and urban areas, you've got sidewalks and culverts. You also have underground utilities. And those underground utilities are going to have to be located. And you typically will go through the North Carolina 811 process and have everything located. Now, fortunately, if you're using a contractor to do this for this construction and it's turnkey, it's on them to locate everything. So that's one thing that comes off your plate. But all of this factors into the cost that the contractor is going to turn around and charge you. Permits are important too, because sometimes you have to have a permit before you can go in and do whatever construction you're going to be doing. And I'm going to speak to the railways in just a moment, but oftentimes you have to basically get permission from the railways to be able to do what Gene was talking about earlier. But you have to factor in permitting cost. And then thirdly, you've got easements and right-of-ways to deal with. We typically do most of our construction on the state right-of-way. The North Carolina DOT has been, over the last few years, extremely reasonable in working with companies who are trying to get broadband out, or at least we have found that in most cases, that they are trying to do everything they can to loosen their restrictions somewhat. As long as they have had some kind of a track record with you and your company, they will be a little bit more permissive. And so we try to stay on the state right-of-way when if at all possible. And then another thing that can inflate your cost is homeowners and having to get actual easements through their property. If you can't use the state right-of-way and you have to go through and get easement to build across, say, several customers' front yards to get down a road that doesn't have state right-of-way on it, that can really inflate your cost as well. Next slide, please. So in the terrain, we have to consider multiple aspects of where we're going to be plowing, because we're building networks in the mountains, we're building networks in the Piedmont, and we obviously have been building on the coastal plain as well. And so in the mountains, as you can imagine, you've got rocks that you've got to get through and around and over and under, and in the Piedmont, you're going to deal with rock and clay as it transitions over, and in the coastal side of things, you're going to deal with clay and more sandy soil. And each one of those have implications on how the construction will go, how long it will take. In the mountains, for instance, with rock boring, they physically have to kind of grind the fiber out, but it's very expensive. It can be anywhere from $150 to $200 per foot, just when you're trying to get through rock. And that can really add up quick. You also have to deal with inclines in the mountains, steep inclines. It makes boring and plowing very difficult, and that will inflate your cost. And the mountains are often, you'll notice when you drive through the mountains that there's not a lot of shoulder oftentimes on the road. And so that means if you are plowing on the state right-of-way on the shoulder, you're right on the edge of the road. So you're right beside the pavement, which can create additional cost with flagmen and having to make sure that you're following DOT standards, because you are actually on the highway while you're plowing. Clay and sand offer different advantages and disadvantages. Sometimes it's easier, but in the coast, oftentimes we will see a lot more moisture and a lot more wetter soil. This can create problems with vehicles, construction vehicles getting stuck. And a lot of times you're going to be on the state right of way, which is going to put you in the ditch or over in the woods or in the swamp. And so that can complicate things too. Just the slightest bit of rain can shut down your construction for several days on the coast. And next slide, please. So other factors kind of are just a conglomerate or a recap of some things. The railways issue is very unique because the railroad companies basically require you, as Gene mentioned earlier, to pay an engineering cost up front to have the work investigated and planned and scheduled, and all of this has to be kind of drawn out and presented to the railways. And then if they agree with what you've designed, after paying the fees and the permits that they require, then they would come back to you with a negotiated case-by-case rate to charge you per year to be under or over their railway. And we typically bore under the railway. So we have to pay the engineering fee up front and get their grace and approval. And then we have to pay a negotiated annual fee as long as we're there. And then we also have to put the actual fiber in, which requires us to bore under the railway. And there's rules and restrictions on how far you have to be away from the railway and how far under you have to go. And so that increases your boring cost. It's not like you can just put a pedestal on one side of the track about just outside of the rail where the train won't hit it. You've got rules that require you to be a certain distance out. And as a norm, the DOT, they do not prefer for you to attach to bridges. So when you're passing over bodies of water, you're not on a bridge anymore like you used to be many years ago. Now, we have seen with the state getting behind broadband and getting more broadband out to rural areas that the DOT is, you know, actually kind of, as I mentioned earlier, pulling back some of the constraints that they had about attaching the bridges, but you still have to get special approval, and it is on a case-by-case basis. So if you can't attach to that bridge, you're going to have to bore underneath of that river or that creek or that canal or whatever that body of water is. And then the demand of materials is also a concern. There's a lot of projects going on right now, and many state and federal funding mechanisms are putting money out there to help build broadband. So we're already seeing the demand for materials and the demand for labor to really peak and spike. And that's causing a limited number of workers and contractors out there. It is also putting the manufacturers of fiber having to do double and triple time to get fiber out to their customers, to their broadband providers who are trying to deploy fiber. So fiber costs are rising and the supply and demand is getting out of whack. And a lot of that is created, I guess, as secondary of the impacts of COVID-19. Next slide, please. Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. Go back for me. I did want to mention here that River Street Networks buried fiber cost per mile average. We see it kind of all over the spectrum, but in a rural environment, not an urban environment, we've seen costs run from $28,000 to $60,000 a mile. And I know that's kind of a wide span, and we're talking about the real cost of fiber, but every project is different. Every county is different. You're going to hit different utilities and different things that will inflate that price. But I did want to give you a perspective of approximately what we look at when we're doing a rural build in a per mile cost. So if you look at in rural environments where you have 8, 10, 12, 20 customers per mile, you can see how the business case can become really difficult and complicated when you're paying $60,000 a mile. Next slide, please. So the last item that I was going to talk with you a little bit about today is what to anticipate on the drop in CPE cost. And CPE stands for customer premise equipment. So we've talked about constructing fiber to get past customers, but there's also some realized cost that comes along with getting the customers connected. And that average drop, what we see, can be anywhere from 175 to 250 feet in length. And we see prices all over from $1.25 to almost $2 per foot for the drop cost. Then you have to buy an optical network terminal, which is basically a little computer that attaches on the exterior of the house, and the fiber will plug into that. And then you come out of that box and you wire the inside of the house. Now there is a different model where that ONT actually sits inside the house. And that terminal becomes kind of the gateway in the home, if you will, providing wireless and some other things. But We choose to hang our ONT on the outside for a demarcation so that our technicians can come and not have to go in the house to troubleshoot problems for customers. There's also batteries that are associated with keeping lifeline services active on that fiber network. So that little computer that's on the outside of the house or inside has to have constant power in order for the light that's coming down that fiber to be translated back into voice and video and data. And so if you have a power failure, as many experience this time of the year due to inclement weather or during hurricane season, then that ONT on the outside isn't going to have power to translate the light that's sitting right there at the box coming from the provider into TV and voice and data. And if you can provide a battery backup to hold the lifeline service up, then the traditional phone service would still work, because we're still seeing a ton of areas in the rural markets where cellular data just is not working well enough to help elderly people or young families with young children who might have babysitters over, what have you, to be able to have a lifeline phone service. So it's important for a battery to be there to keep that service up. And there are two different batteries. There's one that will keep the phone service up for 8 hours, and there's a battery that'll keep it up for 20. And those are various prices. And then inside wiring, the whole home has to typically be rewired. The copper service that was there to provide phone service and DSL ain't going to work like it needs to take this huge fast service coming in on fiber and give it to the customer all over their home. So we rewire their house typically, put different Ethernet ports in different locations for them. We install a wireless router, and those routers can vary depending on what levels of support the broadband company wants to provide, all the way up to around $150. So all of that said, you're looking at about $1,200 to $2,400 per customer just to get them connected to the fiber that passes their home. And that's all I had. So I guess we'll jump over to Mark Boxer.
And before we do that, I just wanted to throw in two other costs that we pretty commonly see. One is called remediation. When you dig up people's yards, you got to put it back the way it was. Okay. And sometimes that can get pretty expensive because some folks are pretty picky. And the other issue is damages. If you hit somebody's sewer line, which is the most common thing to hit and bury in, but anything else you had, gas lines or electric lines, you have to pay to fix all that stuff. And so if your contractor's not careful, you're going to get some of those, and the most careful guy in the world is going to hit some sewer pipes. It always happens. Next, we're going to go on to Mark Boxer, and Mark is going to talk about the future, I guess, of fiber. I mean, what does this all mean in the long-term costs? So I'll hand it off, and Mark is with OFS. And by the way, Mark and OFS have very graciously agreed to sponsor this today. And Mark is on our board already anyhow, so we love Mark. Also, wanted to just point out that if you have any questions to answer at the end of these presentations, you can use the question and answer or the chat to ask us questions, and we are going to have a question session at the end. So take it away, Mark.
Yeah. So thank you very much, Doug. Thanks to Gene and to Greg. So going to spend some time just with some additional data points on the cost of fiber, but just a little bit of background. OFS is a manufacturer of fiber and cable, and I am lucky enough to live in Beaufort County, North Carolina. So I'm coming to you from a farmhouse in Beaufort County, North Carolina, connected by a River Street fiber. So I am very grateful for the service, and grateful to be able to live in, you know, a rural place in North Carolina and be, you know, fully connected to the world. And be able to do what I do from, you know, where I am. So let's head into the slide. We're going to spend just a lot of time on, you know, just, you know, kind of filling in some of the blanks, and hopefully, you know, rounding out the picture.
Can I jump in here one more time, Mark?
Absolutely.
Just want to let you all know these slides will be available. We're going to post them on our website after the end of the webinar. So they're not on there now, but they'll be here later. So
demand continues to increase, and showed this slide in a previous webinar for the people who have attended prior webinars, but it is also something that wanted to go ahead and just start this section and highlight it again. And this was a, a projection from the Fiber Broadband Association Technology Committee. And so I've been pretty deeply involved with that for the past decade or so. And over the past 6 months, we looked at the number of streams, both upstream and downstream, and the potential bandwidth required for each one of those streams for a family of four, and put that together for a projection into, you know, the bandwidth demand for the future. And one of the things that's kind of interesting about this graph is when you look at it, it looks like it's very, you know, it's very large, but what's interesting, and the demand is very large, but what's interesting is I have heard that we see some people that say that it's very large, have also heard some people say that it's not large enough. And so it's very interesting that, you know, we're kind of in the middle of what we've heard. But the point is about this is that demand is increasing. We don't see anything that is going to change that trend. And so we're going to need additional bandwidth. And if we don't have that bandwidth, what happens in a household is people start rationing. And, you know, just rationing is not a good thing for bandwidth. And certainly, you know, as a society, we've enabled people to have electricity. So, you know, an example that I like to use is I can run the air conditioner and run the refrigerator at the same time. And there's really no reason that we should have to ration, you know, moving forward with bandwidth, as, you know, we have seen that, you know, the stuff that runs over these networks is very, very important. So, Doug, if you can head to the next slide. So fiber is a long-lived asset. And we've talked about this before. If you look at just the different grades or the different generations of copper, the generations of wireless and cellular, you can see that over the years, we've had a lot of different generations where just product enhancements or service enhancements with both copper and fiber, or copper and wireless, but fiber, the single fiber that was introduced in the early 1980s is still viable and compatible today. And we are continuing to see, you know, basically we have not filled up the fiber yet. And so we are continuing to find new services and new ways to fill it, but we are nowhere close to fiber's capacity. And fiber stands the test of time. So that's something is fiber is a long-lived asset. And we talked about this in one of the previous webcasts, you know, that our expectation as manufacturers is that if it's deployed with our recommendations, we expect it to last for multiple decades. So, Doug, if you can hit the space bar, and the reason I bring this up, on the previous slide, just showed 3G, 4G, 5G on the cellular side, and there we don't have full coverage of 5G yet in this country, and you can see that 6G. Is already on the it's on the horizon. So this is from a university in Finland that's working on research around 6G and how 6G is going to change our lives. And so, you know, the one point here is that, you know, again, you've seen multiple generations of copper, multiple generations of wireless. Once you do fiber, you're done, and it's a long life asset. So let's continue on from here, and wanted to just set the stage for the rest of the presentation with those. So the price of fiber has dropped dramatically, you know, from the 1990s. So basically it's dropped in the 95%+ range, which is why, you know, in 1990, we were not talking about taking fibers to individual homes. That was a dream in the industry, but it was nowhere close to reality. If you look now, you know, I'm in a farmhouse in rural Beaufort County connected by a fiber. And that's what happens when, you know, the price of fiber drops by, you know, 90%+. So head to the next slide. And so we've also seen additional cost improvements. So Greg mentioned in his presentation the cost of the GPON ONT, which is the device that converts light to electricity. So it's, you know, can be used in, you know, and basically connect with our computers and all our devices. But with the GPON ONT, we've seen significant cost reductions there from when they were first introduced back in the the middle of the 2000s. And so you look at other cost improvements through the years, there's been adoption of fiber optic ribbons, which, you know, with a ribbon, you have 12 fibers and you can splice them all together at once. And so it requires a 12th of the splicing. There has been more widespread deployment of plug and play connectorized connections. Splicer machines have dropped in cost by, you know, 2/3. So in the fiber world, you know, if you're a manufacturer, it makes it a little bit tough because you have to constantly compete. But we are have seen that the the cost curve has been favorable to consumers dramatically over the past 30 years. And we expect that to continue. We think that the cost of fiber is going to continue to drop. And we're also going to see fiber continue to permeate and go to places that it hasn't gone before. So next slide, Doug. So also, in addition to cost reductions, there have been some very fundamental developments in the way that fiber is handled. So if you would ask me, you know, if we would have done, you know, what you see in these two pictures a decade or not, you know, 2 decades ago or 3 decades ago when I entered the industry, there's, you know, I would have said, no way would you ever staple a fiber. No way would you ever tie it into a knot. And, you know, over the past certainly 10 to 15 years, there's been, you know, significant development in ultra-bend and sensitive fibers. And these fibers enable a cord to be, deployed in places where it couldn't have gone before and with methods that, couldn't have been used before. So you can look and you can see that fiber is rugged enough that you can tie it in a knot, and it will really not affect the transmission properties of the fiber inside. You can also staple it. And so these are special types of fibers, but they are also available to help, especially when we start getting inside of homes and inside of, you know, individual businesses. Next slide, Doug. And so it's also less intrusive and easier to install. So you see, you know, this is not a common, or this is a relatively common site with some of the previous technology. And if you can click again, then you will see, so click one more time. There is a fiber in that picture, and you can see that fiber picture. And the fiber is actually embedded in the mortar inside or between the bricks in the wall. And so, you know, fiber has become less intrusive, especially when you start getting into the house, and easier to install. So it's, for a lot of different reasons, fiber makes a lot of sense. So Doug, if you can continue on. Next one, so if you compare, you know, fiber versus cable in a building, in buildings, we have historically deployed both copper and coax, and you can do all of that with one fiber. And so you basically can cut the cost, by half for those types of installations. And, you know, if you're building a new building today and it's not fiber enabled, then, you know, your building is basically already obsolete. So very strongly would recommend to people who are building buildings to make sure that they have fiber infrastructure. It really does not cost very much to deploy, and it gives you the flexibility to provide, you know, next generation services today and tomorrow. Next slide. So this is where we start to get into a lot of the meat. There was the NRTC, the National Rural Telecommunications Co-op, put together a report in this past November. And I thought that this was just, they did a very good job with this. This was with 36 electric co-ops. And so by definition, electric co-ops are gonna be in areas that are some of the least dense. And since it's least dense, you would also conversely think, yeah, it's likely a little bit more expensive than some of the more dense areas. And what I thought was very interesting about this is you look, and especially just given some of the numbers that both Gene and Greg just shared, you know, these numbers are right in line with that. But you can start to see the 50% range for aerial, for make-ready costs, as Gene had highlighted, for underground construction, and then also looking at the cost of the drop. But one of the things I thought that was also very interesting, and I think Greg touched on this most deeply, is there's a pretty wide range for all of these costs. And as both Gene and Greg have highlighted, there are a range of decisions that need to be made when you deploy a network. And so as I think Greg specifically mentioned, there's not one cost for fiber. There are going to be a lot of different numbers that are going to be applicable for a lot of different regions. And there are a lot of different things that go into the overall costs. You know, so are you deploying aerially, underground? What architecture are you using? Even what services are you providing? So all of those really come into play as far as the real cost of fiber. So Doug, what I'd like to do from here is I'd like to head into the next slide, and we're gonna go through a case study that was Gibson EMC in Western Tennessee. And so they operate in Western Tennessee and Southwest Kentucky. And the guy on the left-hand side of the screen is Charles Phillips. And he's, I think, in charge of Gibson Connect, and he's also, vice president of engineering. I can't remember his exact title, but they have been a leader in deploying. And what is interesting about this, if you can go again to, it's a very rural area. Doug, head to the next slide. So this, what he did was he participated in Fiber for Breakfast, and so Fiber for Breakfast is a weekly series that is sponsored by the Fiber Broadband Association of just people's experiences deploying fiber around the country. And he gave an interview for Fiber for the Breakfast last June. And so I went back and looked at that and just took some notes. And some of these notes I think are very applicable. So one thing that's very interesting is that Gibson EMC covers 21 communities, 12 counties, zero Walmarts. So that tells you, kind of where it is, and that this is a very, not a very dense area at all. The service area also includes the 13th poorest county in the nation. They've got about 39,000 meters and around 3,500 miles per distribution. And if you do the math on that, you're in roughly 11 homes per mile. So you're looking at kind of a pretty classic, and this is why I really like this example, because this is a classic electric co-op example in situations where you're not very dense. So this is a GPON deployment. So it uses the PON architecture that Greg had mentioned, where you take one fiber and you spread those fibers out, or split those fibers out into a 1x32 split. This also is a PowerSpace install, and they're using ADSS, as Gene had mentioned, and ADSS is all dielectric self-supporting cable, and they provide triple play services over their network. So Doug, if you can head to the next slide. So just looking at some of the financials, this is what I thought was pretty compelling. So they've got roughly a 40% subscription rate in their area, and their construction costs come in at around $18,000 per mile. And so it's reasonably in line with what I showed just a little while ago with both NRTC, as well as it's a little bit less expensive than what Gene had mentioned. And that actually makes a lot of sense, because they're deploying in a aerially in a relatively rural area. And some of their backbones are also a little bit less large because they don't have quite the population that they are serving versus what Gene is doing in the city of Wilson. But the CapEx of investment I thought was pretty interesting. They had originally budgeted around $3,000 per subscriber, and they ended up at around $2,300 per subscriber. You put all this in with net income, and the net income per subscriber I thought was very, very telling at $393. So even in a very rural area and a relatively poor area with not a lot of population, fiber ultimately can be cash flow positive. And so it's one of those things, and this has been proven time and again throughout the country. I like this example, but I have heard the same story all over the country. So want to highlight and reiterate what both Gene and Greg said. There are a lot of things that we really have to pay attention to, and there can be absolutely a wide range of costs. Within those wide ranges of costs, if you look at the totality, depending on where you are, it potentially can make a lot of financial sense. And again, fiber is long-term infrastructure. So let's keep going, Doug. Yeah. So that was another example of where it has been done, and you put it all together, and it looks pretty exciting. So a cost comparison with OPEX. So one of the advantages of fiber is actually on the OPEX side. So OPEX meaning operational expenses. And so fiber networks historically have been lower cost to operate. And the lower costs are attributed to a number of different things. And I was actually surprised at this, the outcome here. But some of the things, and I'll talk about that in just a second, but lower powering, customer churn, customer support calls are lower than coax and copper. And so if you look at the picture on the right-hand side, this is from a Fiber Broadband Association article or white paper that was put together last year. And what we're looking at there is a 40-kilometer, or what's that, roughly 24-mile circle. And so we've got a big yellow dot in the middle, and that is where the optical line terminal, the OLT, will fit. And that is a fiber dot. So that's basically the electronics that feeds the fiber that goes out to, this whole range. If you look at the orange and the blue, those are powered areas for either coax or DSL. So either copper or coax. And so you can start to see all of the areas that are powered with traditional networks versus the one place in the center with fiber. And so you put all that together and you start to realize that, well, no wonder fiber will be less expensive from an OPEX standpoint as well as from a reliability standpoint. So, each one of these orange and blue dots are potentially points of failure, and that failure happens over time. And so that also means that the fiber network is likely going to be more reliable than these other networks. And one of the interesting things coming back to the study was that fiber actually, one of the main reasons that fiber had lower OPEX costs was actually because customer churn and customer support calls were dramatically lower versus some of these other technologies. And so you put them all together and it turned out to be a much less expensive network. So there is limited data with this on wireless, and there's really no data right now on what's going to be the case with some of the low Earth orbit satellites. As a high Earth orbit satellite customer a decade and a half ago, I'll tell you that was not a very pleasant experience for very low speeds. But it's going to be interesting to see what happens with some of the low Earth orbit satellite items. So let's head on to the next slide. So I did want to spend a little bit of time talking about fiber and wireless. And because I get this question a lot. So wireless loves fiber. And each one of these, fiber does a job, wireless does a job, and they are different jobs. And so fiber loves wireless, wireless loves fiber. And that has been the case now for the past 30 years. Because I'm constantly get the question, when is wireless going to take over fiber? And the answer is it's not. They do different jobs, we should make sure that they do their jobs well. So Doug, if you can hit the next. So if you look at a typical wireless network, it turns out that especially where we are today, virtually every wireless wireless cell site is going to be fiber connected. And really the only thing that's actually wireless is from your telephone to the antenna. And as we go from 4G, 5G, and as we talked about a little bit earlier, 6G, then all of this, in order to be able to deliver a lot of bandwidth, you have to have fiber in the backhaul. There is just not enough spectrum available to do all of this wirelessly, in the background, as well as to also reach the end customer. So if we go to the next slide, if you look at the total cost of ownership, so this is slide or a image that was put together a few years ago looking and comparing 3G, 4G, and 5G, and the number of sites that are needed in order to provide the types of bandwidth that we would expect to see from each one of these technologies. So 3G was the first time that we really started to see any kind of networking take place over the cellular network or any other type of data networking. And so with 4G, we've seen that, and that's where the vast majority of us are still today, is we can do a lot of data stuff, and we're starting to see some video. And where 5G is, the promise of 5G is really to take us to a gigabit per second per subscriber. In order to do that type of, to give that type of bandwidth, you have to have dramatically more cell sites. And that also means that you have to feed fiber much more deeply into the network in order to feed those cell sites. So the reason that I wanted to bring that up is you know, with this final slide. And so this final slide, if you can head on, Doug, whenever you're ready. So this is, you know, looking at the total cost of ownership. And this is something that actually, you know, we have a study in process that at this point, I don't have any real numbers here, but I'm doing things from a qualitative perspective. And so if you hit this is just comparison of fixed wireless versus fiber. So Doug, if you hit the first build, so, you know, typically fiber's first cost is going to be a little bit more expensive for lower data rates. And that's because, and bless you, Gene, but that's because with fiber, you're taking fiber all the way to the home, but with low data rates, you can actually have wireless service that, you know, will be, you know, up to a mile away or potentially a little bit more from, you know, from the house. And so you don't have to go quite as deep into the network. As we move to higher speeds, and as we go to higher speeds, this is where things get a lot more dicey for, you know, fixed wireless service. So, you know, and also, you know, the costs are going to start to increase for fixed wireless pretty significantly. And the other thing about fixed wireless, especially when we're starting to look at high demand rates, and that was one of the reasons why I wanted to highlight at the very beginning of the presentation, you know, how much demand we expect to see over the next several years. And when we're talking about infrastructure, we're talking about long-term, multi-decade asset, you know, that is going to be around for a very long time. And so it has to be able to withstand, you know, the demand over multiple decades. And so in order to do that with wireless, you basically would have to, you know, bring everything much, much closer to the end user. And with, you know, 1,000, you're potentially talking about less than roughly 1,000 feet or smaller. And then if you go on to the next slide, Doug, or the next build, you know, you can see that as you start even going further, then for any kind of larger amount of bandwidth, wireless, you know, it's just not going to make sense. And so for the people who, you know, think, well, we got wireless and now, you know, and now we're done. Not really, because the demand is growing so quickly. And so, you know, as the demand grows so quickly, we have to think long-term, and that's, and where with fiber, you have a long-term asset that is a long-term proven asset that, you know, where the costs are continuing to drop. So, I think, Doug, if we go to the last, I think that was my last slide, and it was just kind of a summary of, you know, the overall, but, you know, many costs affect the real cost of fiber, you know, certainly aerial construction factors that Gene had mentioned and the underground factors. And Greg highlighted a lot of those throughout the entire network. Fiber is a long-term asset. You know, fiber and wireless are complementary. Wireless shouldn't serve as a substitute for fiber and vice versa. And fiber, you know, absolutely has the lowest cost of ownership over the long-term. So we are at 12 o'clock. I think we've got about, 15 minutes for some questions. And I know we've had a number of questions that have come in. And Doug, you're on mute.
We have gotten some questions in. And so let me just start asking a few of those. This is probably aimed at Gene, but it could be to any of you. There's been a lot of talk about one-touch make-ready, making aerial fiber more affordable. What are you guys' experience with that?
So far, actually, Doug, we have not had any experience with the one touch. I think it's probably going to be a region by region. If you have utilities that play well together, I think that'll work. But so far, we have not had any experience with that yet. I don't know, Greg may have had some with River Street.
We have, I mean, as far as one touch goes, we haven't found that it doesn't always work out, because it's hard. You have to have everything just right. You have to almost have a crystal ball to know exactly what's going to happen there. And that oftentimes is very hard in areas that are growing rapidly. You can plan for everything, but you're not going to catch it all.
I think one of the biggest factors too for us would probably be the coordination between everybody to do a one touch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just want to throw in, I've actually found it to be less expensive, but takes just as much time. And that's the whole point, is everyone hoped it would be faster. Mm-hmm. One touch breaks poles into two types, easy ones and hard ones. And the hard ones are just as hard as they were before. Those ones that Gene showed us the pictures of that were real ugly, those still, you can't go you can't use one touch on those complicated poles. So thank you. Got some questions about using plowing in more dense areas, and this comes from Al Bonnyman at Concord, and wanted to talk about, have you had any experience of plowing in areas where there's driveways and all that sort of stuff? Or, you know, how do you, this back to Greg, how do you decide when to use plowing versus boring? And
well, a lot of it is going to be totally subjective. So if you're going into a subdivision that's well kept, as I think Mark kind of highlighted earlier, or maybe you, Doug, it was Doug, that you got to get everything back just like you found it. And so oftentimes in subdivisions, we'll spend a lot more money doing boring simply because it's just not feasible to try to go through there any other way, especially with sidewalks. I mean, what people traditionally don't think about as a layperson, you know, you just want the stuff to work at your house. But when someone's coming down the left-hand side of the road underground and you've got houses on the left and the right-hand side of the road, you've got to get under that highway. You have to go across under a driveway. You may have to go under a sidewalk. In very rural environments where people don't have paved driveways, then you can simply turn and run down the edge of their rock driveway and plow it right up to the house. So all of those are implications that are going to impact the cost. To give you an exact answer would be really hard, but I hope that helps.
It does. I like to say too, what we ran into in Wilson, to speak to that question, in the older neighborhoods where you had larger lots, say the lot was 100, 120 feet or more street frontage, plowing could be feasible. But in these newer, more high density, even though they're single family home developments, you start to have a yard that's 60 or 80 feet across the front and you cut out 15 feet of that for a driveway, it is not feasible at all to try to plow that, because you're going to go basically 20, 30 feet and have to stop and bore under something anyway. So we, like Greg, we used a missile bore to do a lot of that because it was so dense and hard to get to.
I'd throw one other issue in there. The public right-of-way is often the first 3 to 4 to even 10 or 15 feet of people's yards, and they all assume that that's part of their yards. Mm-hmm. So we just run into people like, you can't dig through here. That's a tulip bed. Like, honey, you built your flowers in the public right-of-way. We have to go through there, and we're not going to put those back because, you know, we probably end up putting them back anyhow, mm-hmm. but you're not obligated to do that. So it gets to be really complicated in real life because, you know, people don't realize where their right-of-way ends. I mean, you know, the public actually owns quite a bit of your front yard, and people don't understand that. So, interesting question here. Does anyone know, this is in the mountains, could you put fiber in the guardrails? Has anyone ever heard of that? I've not, but that's
it looks to me like a good place to make a target out of your fiber for the next ice storm. And
yeah. We typically try to do things planning for the fact that we want this fiber as far away from danger as possible. And obviously, when you put a pedestal on the side of the road, the more pedestals you put and the closer you put them to the state right-of-way, the greater chance or risk you would have from a car wreck plowing over that fiber and taking the network down. So, I mean, in theory, guardrails sounds like a cool thing, but it could really be a detriment to the quality experience of service for customers.
Well, to even take that further, when you build on country roads, one place that I've done some work on with a client is the route between Philadelphia and Harrisburg in Pennsylvania. the whole road, half of it is very rural and windy. And there's been so many poles knocked down over the years and fiber cuts from trucks hitting poles that they're now having to replace that fiber route simply because there's literally been hundreds of cuts. And this is an aerial up and pole line. So, you know, anything you can do to make your line safer is an interesting thing. So,
yeah, there have been situations before where people have experimented with fiber actually in the roadway. And there have been some of those. I really haven't heard of a lot of that just over time. It comes up, it goes away, it comes up, it goes away. I think we're constantly looking for new pathways that can make sense. But the two tried and true ones so far have been aerial and underground.
Next question. This goes back to something that Greg had said about the lack of work crews, and it mentioned that it's getting harder and harder even just to find crews. The question is, you know, what can we do to train more technicians in North Carolina? And I think that Mark is dying to answer that question.
No, the question was, the question was, how can we engage the community colleges? And
right.
For that, one thing I would like to say is I'm gonna give a very cagey answer, but I would say stay tuned. So watch this channel. I know that Gene has been involved already and done a lot of work, but you know, I think I would say just watch this channel, because we're hoping that we're going to be able to do some things that will be very significant over the next while.
Someone just asked, what is a missile bar, since Gene brought it up?
It gets its name from the fact that the actual head of the bar looks like a missile. They typically are 2 to 4 inches in diameter, and they're run by using an air compressor. So you'll dig a pit that's probably about 3.5 feet long by maybe 12 inches wide. You place the missile in it, and then when you turn on the air compressor, it actually thumps, and it will run basically unguided in the direction that you point it. But it's not good for something that you would want to bore long distances, 15, 20 feet at a time, it's fine. But since they're not guided, they could hit a root, they could find a soft spot in the soil, and they could basically divert. But they're really good for tight spaces. But anyway, gets its name because it literally looks like a missile with a long hose attached to the back of it.
Next question is, we've all talked, every one of you talked about how expensive it could be to build in the mountains. And so we know that's absolutely the case. Is it realistic that can be done in North Carolina? And I'll throw in the first answer is not without grant money. Grant money is what makes the difference, but throw that out to you. And that sort of raises the question even back to Greg when he's talking about building everywhere. He never talked about how you pay for it. So
that's true. Yeah. And I think in most of these rural areas, as I was saying earlier, when you're looking at 10 to 12 customers a mile, we've got areas we serve where there's 4 or 5 customers per mile. And so you simply have to have subsidies to build a business case. When you first do the financial analysis and you see this is going to take you 15 to 20 years to pay back your investment, those are the types of models that you've got to have subsidies either from the state or federal level to help cut that cost. But as far as whether or not fiber is the all-fit solution or wireless is the all-fit solution for the mountains, that's not necessarily the case. We've deployed fiber to customers who were in some of the most rockiest mountain terrain you've ever seen, and we buried it or plowed it or bored it or cut it, and we did whatever we had to do to get it there. What we do find is that in most instances, wireless is a quick-to-market deployment technology that if you deploy it, you can get it out there within 24 months, and that gives customers a sense of broadband a little sooner. Most of your federally funded programs that help subsidize broadband are based on a 6-year build-out timeline. And so when we're sitting in a COVID world where we have students and parents all at home and they need access to reliable broadband, it's going to be a mix of both. But our ultimate goal at River Street is to get people on wireless and then work towards a business model for fiber and then move them to fiber as quickly as we can. I think Mark showed you earlier that there's going to be a, you know, just a real influx of more demand for broadband. The devices, the technology, the things that we're buying from the box stores and bringing into our homes, and then the many, many devices we're connecting in our home, many as in a lot of devices, from wireless security cameras to, you know, streaming devices to tablets to everything, you know, refrigerators, vacuum cleaners. I mean, who would have thought, you know, all these things are going to pull down on your broadband.
I bought a $10 thermometer and it was connected to the Wi-Fi. That was kind of mind-boggling. Like, really? It really is? So here's an interesting question, and it sort of goes to everything we talked about. And it starts with Mark's first graph about how realistic are those future demands. I'll take the first shot at it because I've been tracking this forever. That demand curve goes back to the early 1980s, and it's been growing at the same rate now from 1980 to today. And what we can see is exactly what we're talking about here, more and more devices in the home, and also some really big things coming down. I mean, the next thing that we're going to see now, we now have 8.5% of all, and that's up to 14% of all the homes in the U.S. somewhere subscribe to gigabit services. So we're going to start seeing those being delivered. And the number one of those is telepresence, meaning you're going to be able to have a meeting with someone who looks like they're sitting in the room with you, which makes our webinar really interesting because we're all going to get to see Gene's room finally. And but that takes a huge amount of bandwidth. It's probably going to be a 50 up and 50 down minimum amount of bandwidth, and probably a lot more than that over time. So the answer is that curve, to me, every network engineer struggles with that curve. They never believe it. They always undersize a new fiber route, always. And it turns out they're electronics, and it turns out that 3 or 4 years later, they missed it because they're too conservative. I've never seen that curve fail yet. So I'll throw it out to the rest of you. But
you know, I agree completely. You know, we see the advent of 4K and 8K. We hear AR and VR, you know, upstream and downstream. We're back to the whole, you know, why would anybody need more 4K? I mean, the growth has been relentless, and absolutely, you know, the table is set for that growth to be even more relentless moving forward as we continue to see more and more people adopt, you know, all of these, you know, very interesting and in many situations just very life enhancing technologies.
We are just about up against our time frame here. So I think maybe there's some other good questions we would love to answer, but I think, Krista, if you want to come on and talk about what's next for our group, and then.
Sure thing. This is, I'm Krista Vinson, and on behalf of the entire board of NC Broadband Matters, these gentlemen who did such a great job today, I think this was our richest webinar yet of the half a dozen that we've done. Our board includes also Jane Patterson, Catherine Rice, Deb Watson, Alan Fitzpatrick. Thank you all so much for joining us. For more great content, please check back for a March 23rd webinar where we will be discussing models communities are using to deploy broadband and drawing on some local examples from across North Carolina. And then on May 25th, how to fund a broadband network through grants and loans, and taking a close look at all the action at the federal level lately with COVID relief. Check out our podcasts, where the Institute for Local Self-Reliance's Christopher Mitchell has talked about everything from mapping to North Carolina's history and future with broadband, the homework gap, healthcare, digital inclusion, it's all there. And prior webinars, including one we did on January that inspired today's session, discussing the difference between fiber and wireless, can be found on our website. We also have regionally specific analysis that our board did with councils of government, council of government partners across North Carolina. So check all of that out at nchartsgigabit.com. That's hearts with an F. Look forward to seeing you online in the near future. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.